Welcome back to Minds Matter, a podcast sponsored by the Monash Center for Consciousness and Contemplative Studies. I'm Ava.
And I'm Beth. And on Minds Matter, we talk about research from psychology and neuroscience whilst occasionally talking through our own personal experiences. And I'm actually recording in a new space right now. It's called The Space, and it's a podcast studio in Brunswick run by CoLabs, which is this cool biotech CoLab working space I've been hanging out in. So shout out CoLab, shout out The Space.
I'm still at home, so nothing has changed there. But actually, on this episode, I got to record in person with Dr. Pratik Sheth Pandey, who also goes by Kano, who is an assistant professor of communications at UC Santa Barbara, where I'm currently at as well. And Kanu's work focuses on the political communication of humor and the role of political humor in shaping how we perceive our roles as citizens and how it influences our engagement with political issues. So we talk about how humor can influence engagement with news pieces as well. So you can kind of think Daily Show, John Oliver, that style of engaging with news. And we also discuss a comparative analysis of political humor in India and the US that Kanu has been working on, examining how different cultural contexts shape the role and reception of political satire.
My name is Pratik Sheth Pandey. I go by my nickname Kanu. I am a new assistant professor at UCSB, Department of Communication. I study political communication. I focus on political humor. I'm trying to understand the role of humor in citizenship, or how does humor and comedy and political satire make us think about ourselves as citizens and shape our citizenship? Currently, my interests are in trying to understand political humor in India specifically and doing some comparative analysis with political humor in the US.
So how did you get interested in humor and politics?
How did I get interested in humor?
Because you're hilarious.
No, I think it's the other way around. I think I was a very non-hilarious person. And then I wanted to be hilarious because the people who were hilarious were liked. And I wanted to be liked in school, high school, college, stuff like that. So I would take a lot of interest in comedy shows, would pay attention to their different mannerisms, etc. I would be the person who would do impressions of school teachers. So I would like that kind of comedy a lot. And then when I got into college, I suddenly had access to all of this internet and could, like, you know, illegally download a bunch of things and watch a lot of things on YouTube, but otherwise as well. And that just, like, opened me up to different ways of doing comedy. It opened me up to shows like The Daily Show and John Oliver's show on YouTube and whatnot. And that then took me in a certain direction after that to not only be interested in humor, but also be interested in politics after that. So that's how I got interested in humor. And I got fascinated by what late night shows were in the US, because it's a very US specific phenomenon. It's a very American thing. I was very curious why these pretty expensively produced shows are being telecast at 11 p.m. or 11:30 p.m. And why are all of these high-status celebrities showing up to promote their shows? Like, who's watching these shows? And turns out a lot of people are watching these shows. So that got me really interested in what is going on over here, where people are watching these late-night shows, and these shows have become a space where people talk about politics for some reason. And that is something that I did not see in India. And they were much more openly talking about politicians and criticizing them in ways that I did not see happening in India. But then around the time that I was in college, there were certain comedian groups or collectives on YouTube in India who were beginning to do things like that. And in the process, also getting some pushback, but they were doing some interesting things in that space and were aspiring to be like US-based comedians, right? And then more academically, I started becoming more interested in, like, I don't think I'm as interested in machine learning or AI. I'm more interested in human behavior. And I was fascinated by a class on neuroscience. So I was like, oh, I have these personal interests in media. I want to study neuroscience. Where can I do both? Magically, there was a place where I could, and I applied and got in. And I moved to the US to pursue this in 2016. I moved here in August 2016, and the elections happened in November. So during that whole time, I was very excited to follow all of these comedy shows in real time almost. And that gave me an insight into things that were happening politically. You would see them on TV channels, but then you would see them being covered by these shows in a slightly different way. They would interpret them and analyze them for you and make jokes about them in certain ways. So it gave me an insight on what is considered funny, what is not considered funny, which issues are they focusing to talk about, which are they not focusing to talk about, what are they making fun of, and what these comedy shows were platforming versus not platforming, right? There was this whole controversy around Donald Trump showing up on Jimmy Fallon's The Tonight Show. Jimmy Fallon, like, ruffled his hair. He invited both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And because he ruffled Donald Trump's hair and Donald Trump was just like this likable person, a lot of people were like, why are you platforming this person who is very hateful to be likable? You are actually contributing to his success in some ways, which is all kind of muddied. There are many opinions to and for that argument. I don't necessarily have a clear opinion on that. But all of that made me really interested in what role exactly is this kind of comedy playing in how people think about politics. So both in terms of like how they think politics works, but also their political ideology, also what their role is in all of this. Does that actually make them better informed as citizens? Does that actually make them feel like they can influence change in politics or not? So this last thing of like, do they think they can influence change in politics, which is political efficacy, that captured my attention a lot. So that is something that I then started exploring, like the relationship between this type of news-based comedy and political efficacy and how those are like interconnected with each other to an extent. And then how does that then affect how we engage with news information? Like, does that make us more knowledgeable? Does that make us want to share this news with other people, talk about it, etc.? So my dissertation was about that. One part of data that I have is from the neuroscience experiment that we did, where we were trying to see the effect of humorous framings of news on knowledge and sharing of political information, right? Yeah. So in that, one of the secondary analysis that I did in that was trying to see if there was an effect of efficacy on sharing of news items. That study, which was led by Jason Cornell, amazing, great professor and human being at Ohio State, he designed this beautiful experiment where we wanted to experimentally test whether political information, if it is framed in a humorous way or like framed as a joke or not as a joke, whether that has an impact on whether we remember it better, whether we recognize the information better, and whether we want to share that information with others better. So a bunch of advertising related research will tell you that if you make funny ads, people will want to share it better and it will lead to a greater spread of the ad. And also because if it is funny, then you are likely to remember it a little bit better, etc. So for this particular paper, the idea was, can we show participants a set of video clips in which there is a news anchor? Because a lot of these news comedy shows, whether it be Saturday Night Live, they have that segment on Weekend Update, be it The Daily Show or any other, they all have this kind of man in a suit and tie behind a desk, talking like news anchors typically talk, right? So can we have a similar like video setup where somebody, a news anchor looking like person, can deliver a news information? And can we have equal number of video clips where that news information is framed humorously and equal number where it is framed in a regular news-like manner? And can we then see if people remembered the funny ones better than the non-funny ones? Can we then see if they recognize the funny information better or not, and if they want to share the funny ones more than the non-funny ones? And can we simultaneously test what the brain activity was like as they are watching those video clips? So we had a bunch of participants, we put them inside a functional MRI scanner, and we showed them 16 video clips which were non-humorously framed and 16 video clips which were humorously framed. Each clip was about 7 to 12 seconds or so, short clips, right? The humorous version would have the same first sentence, and the second sentence would be a punchline. those punchlines were written by a comedy writer that the team had hired at that time, who used to write for The Tonight Show at some point, for Jay Leno. Yeah. And they hired two actors to act like news anchors and shot them in front of a green screen and made it look like a news studio almost, with a chyron underneath them which said their name. So the participants were told, these are news anchors who are auditioning for a local news station. And the local news station is trying out two different formats. They weren't told that this is going to be funny necessarily. So that they are not expecting it to be funny.
Right.
And then they went inside the scanner. Inside the scanner, they saw all of these video clips. Then they were brought out. For 20 minutes, they did double-digit multiplication problems. And that was a distraction task. So after they did the distraction task, then they were given basically a blank sheet of papers that you saw 32 clips. Recall whatever you can. And they were able to recall the funny news information much better than the non-humorously framed information. Then they were presented with the correct and incorrect versions of the information they saw in each clip. And they were asked to recognize the correct version versus the incorrect version. In that one, we did not see any significant difference between humor and non-humor. But in sharing, there was a significant difference. People were presented with the same clips that they were shown inside the scanner. And they were asked, would you be likely to share this with your friends and family over email, in person, over social media, over text? And just on an average, it seemed like they wanted to share the funny ones more than the non-funny ones. And then we also measured some other variables like political ideology, etc., which we used as covariates, which at least for this particular study did not seem to have any significant effects. So that is the outline of the study. And those were the main tests and primary hypotheses and results for that study. What I was also interested in as a secondary analysis is to test what the role of political efficacy is in all of this. So we also measured some other variables, including political knowledge, interest, efficacy towards the end. And I just wanted to see if political efficacy is associated with sharing of political information. And it seemed like people who had higher political efficacy wanted to share the clips more in general. And there seemed to be some interaction effect in that people who were high in efficacy wanted to share both humorous and non-humorous clips about at the same level. There was no significant difference. But people who were low in efficacy, people wanted to share humor more than non-humor. So that, again, it's a small sample. So any interaction effect needs to be understood with a significant grain of salt. But that to us was an indication that, well, it seems like perhaps humor could be acting as a gateway into political information for people who are low on efficacy and don't feel like they understand politics very well. Because people who are high on political efficacy feel efficacious enough to want to share political information and talk about it, whether it be funny or not funny or whatever. So for instance, people who just like are news junkies would also love to watch John Oliver and Jon Stewart. Not necessarily an indication that they are watching news because they are interested in comedy. They're just interested in news and politics, so they are watching everything that is news and politics. But people who are low on efficacy and they don't feel like they have a good position in politics, they don't feel like they understand politics very well, for them it seemed like humor seemed to increase intentions to share. So that was interesting to me. I wasn't sure if political efficacy was actually driving anything over there. We hadn't manipulated political efficacy, right? So then the challenge became, how can you manipulate political efficacy? So then in my dissertation, that's what I did. I tried to manipulate both humor and efficacy and observe their effects on sharing. And the interaction effects that I got at the end of it, just spoiler alert, didn't actually see any significant interaction effects over there. But I ended up doing this whole other thing to actually try to manipulate political efficacy to begin with, which and devised a type of intervention which would try to move political efficacy, for which I have some political efficacy data for.
So when you actually were trying to manipulate political efficacy, what was the result of that? Was it that everyone was more likely to share the funny content in the end?
In that one, actually, I saw a reverse result. The difference of interaction that I saw with my results was that people in high efficacy were almost equally likely to share humor and non-humor. So that stayed consistent. People in low efficacy, or like people who were manipulated or randomly assigned to a condition of low political efficacy, were less likely to share humorous information than the regular political information. That is very interesting, because that is just the flip of what we saw in the small sample neuroscience study. Mm. And also because I would not expect that to happen. So again, like, I can come up with some post hoc analysis or, you know, post hoc explanations of it, but that is a very puzzling result that I got from that. Yeah.
It's nice to talk to someone who has a job and who had puzzling results, though, because I feel like we don't usually hear that. So in that 2021 paper,
right,
you not only looked at the outcomes of this funny versus non-funny news, but you also looked at the processes that might lead to like more sharing and more remembering.
Yep.
And specifically, you were interested in these two processes of potentially it being more rewarding, which intuitively was the one that I thought was going to be
same,
the one driving everything. Maybe humor is more rewarding. Or, which I think was really interesting, was maybe humor leads to more mentalizing, so more theory of mind and like thinking about other people, I guess, or you probably have better words to describe that.
No,
could
no,
you talk about those two processes and the reasoning behind them and then what you found?
You introduced that really well. So those were the two processes that we were interested in to test with the brain data that we had. With reward, that was the more intuitive hypothesis that humor would be more rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
We did not find evidence to support that. In fact, technically, our statistical analysis showed that VMPFC activity or the reward region activity was slightly lower for humorous versus non-humorous. That was another puzzling result that we still don't clearly know why that is. My first reaction to that was that I think these clips are perhaps not funny.
Not funny, yeah, I was about to ask.
But then, you know, manipulation checks of you know, asking people if they found it funny or not.
Yeah.
They were saying that they found it funny, which then leads to all of these other considerations about when we ask people whether something is funny or not. Yeah. This is one of my hypotheses that I think they are responding to whether you think it is meant to be funny or not. So if people are able to recognize a joke, you know, they are saying, okay, I recognize this as a joke. It's meant to be funny. Mm-hmm. All right. On a scale of 1 to 5, it's 3. But the other thing is not meant to be a joke. I get it. It's 1 or 2, you know. Plus, think listening to jokes inside an MRI scanner is not the best place to listen to joke.
True.
Because you hear that metallic bang over and over again. And then you're trying to look at a video and understand political humor. And you're not allowed to move your head. So it's not the best way to enjoy humor either. So I think those are my hypotheses of why it might be affecting these results in some way. So that was the reward result. With the mentalizing, the idea was with sharing as one of the outcome variables that we had, it has been seen that mentalizing regions, as you explained, which are about perspective taking of understanding that another person has a psychological state and assessing their psychological state. And there is a set of brain regions that get activated when we are participating in any kind of mentalizing related psychological processing. And we wanted to see if those regions get activated when people were engaging with humorous videos versus non-humorous videos. And the idea there was that they might want to share it. And it has been seen that for messages which are associated with more sharing, which are associated with more intentions to share as well, those typically elicit greater mentalizing activity. One explanation of that is, well, you want to share it with somebody. So when you consume it or when you're exposed to it, you're also in some ways making an assessment of all of these other people that you want to share it with. So what will they like? What will they not like? With humor, especially, like, you are not only trying to assess, oh, will my friends actually like it and can I like share it with them, etc. You're also trying to assess what the meaning of the joke is. And you're trying to assess if other people, if they listen to that same joke, would like it or not. Because laughter a lot of times is also, you know, socially constructed. So you're trying to make all of these like social assessments. And we hypothesize that is what would lead to greater mentalizing related activity when you're being exposed to humor versus non-humor. And that's what happened. So that was encouraging to see that there were certain regions within the mentalizing network which were getting more activated, but on an average, it was greater activity. What we also then saw was that the mentalizing brain activity was able to predict sharing intentions as well. So we saw this nice triangulation of humor led to greater mentalizing activity, led to greater sharing there as well, which was nice to put a bow on.
So is the idea that you're spontaneously mentalizing, like when you're being told this information in your head, if it's funny or maybe you're more likely, and I mean, I know you mentioned that it's also like maybe you're trying to figure out like what the joke teller had in mind,
right,
but
right.
that we're wired to be like, oh, there's something maybe also unexpected happening right now, and I'm going to tell someone about this. Like, is that the idea?
That's
how conscious is it, I guess? Also,
I don't know. I think that is one of the ideas. That's one
it's
of...
so surprising. I don't know that, like, we're mentalizing when you get told that we're funny. I don't know. It was just like, when I read it, I was surprised.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is what is the argument for any kind of sharing outcome related paper which uses mentalizing, right? Like that one of the social cognitions that you are participating in right now or engaging with right now is assessment of other people's psychological states, especially those other people that you would like to share it with later. Mm. So even though you're not consciously thinking about that, that is one of the things that you're engaging with in that moment. With humor, I just think this is not particularly tested. And I think to tease apart what kind of social cognition is actually happening would require a more complicated experimental design. Yeah. I think that because humor is one of the more polysemic forms of communication, by polysemic, I mean has many meanings and it is open to interpretation. It has subjective meaning to it, as opposed to something that is relatively more straightforward. Like you only need to understand the dictionary meaning of the words and grammar of the language in order to understand the meaning of the sentence. Between those two, between something that is very literal and between something that is polysemic, if you are trying to engage with or being exposed to something that is more polysemic, then your social cognitions are more activated because then you're trying to make meaning out of what is being told to you based on a bunch of different social cues. And one of those cues might be, what will my friends or family like? Or would they like it or not like it? You know, this person is saying it. Why did they say tube light like that? Mm-hmm. Why did they stress on that like that? Do they mean this thing or do they mean that thing? You know, like a flurry of complicated social cues are coming at us. And because we don't have a stable vocabulary and grammatical system to rely on to interpret the meaning of types of communication, you're trying to rely on all sorts of social cues. And that, I think, leads to more social cognition. So, of course, that more automatic way of thinking about others is happening. But I think that's just one part of it.
So do you think part of it is just kind of like deeper processing because you have to maybe think a little bit more about these things, which I think on the one hand feels contrary to what it's like to watch John Oliver versus CNN, because it's like, I like to watch John Oliver because it's entertaining. So like it's half information and half entertaining. So you get like the best of both worlds. But then maybe when it's these like pieces of information, then it's actually like, oh, I wasn't expecting this to be funny, or I wasn't expecting them to kind of like throw this reversal on me.
Right.
So I need to kind of think about what just happened more. So we're processing that information deeper. I don't know.
Really good question, because I think in the communication field, especially in the more survey-based research on consumption of daily show like comedy and political behaviors and beliefs and whatnot, the dominant way to think about it and dominant theorizing, at least in the early 2010s, has been that a humor or humorous ways of framing make you engage in peripheral processing, and non-humorous way of engaging with it makes you engage in central processing. So central processing means that you're engaging with the argument that is being placed. It's a persuasion related model, that how are you getting persuaded to believe in a certain argument or be moved by a certain argument. So you can be persuaded by a certain argument if you're centrally processing that information, engaging with the substantive argument of the appeal. And the peripheral processing means that you are engaging with all the peripherals of the message, not the central message, like how is it being presented? What is the tone? Who is the person who is saying it? What is the medium, etc.? That you are focusing more on the peripheral cues than on the argument itself. The theory says that for a strong argument, engaging with the central leads to best persuasion outcomes. And for a weak argument, a more peripheral processing leads to most persuasion. Because when you're engaging with the peripheral cues, then you are less likely to counter-argue with the message. And if it is a weak argument, then you want people to counter-argue less. I think that is the idea over there. Within that construct, humor has been seen as a peripheral cue a lot of times. And I think that can be true. So as you mentioned, shows like John Oliver, they make jokes about very serious topics and also talk about serious topics. So it gives you a combination of both entertainment and information, depending on the audiences that we are talking about. Some audiences actually leave with more knowledge about the information and the topic that they're talking about. And in that way, humor seems to be effective in making them interested in that topic. Humor seems effective in persuading them to like think about it, take some action maybe as well. So this argumentation of that humor is like this peripheral cue, which is only serving to distract you from the real issue, falls flat. And that is what I found to be kind of disconcerting about that kind of reasoning in that literature as well. So my argument there was that if in order to understand the joke, you need to also understand the information well, then humor is a central part. Right. Or like you need to do central processing to understand humor. Yeah. And then it has all of these like positive effects in the way that we just talked about, right? Like if you're watching these news comedy shows which take deep dives into topics, that's why sometimes they have some significant effects, because in order to understand the joke, you need to understand the topic itself. For instance, in education, some teachers and professors would use jokes, but the jokes that they are making is about the weather or about the pets that they have at home. And then they were like, all right, let's get back to electromagnetic theory. So then it's just like two different things. Then humor is simply being used as a distraction and levity. And then it is not part of the main argument that you're talking about. So if that is being done, then yes, it will lead to peripheral processing. So it really depends on how humor is being used and how the joke is being constructed. And depending on how connected it is to the topic, it will have different effects.
That makes it sound pretty hard to study.
As you can tell, you're asking what effects did you observe? I'm like, well, nothing.
No, you just observe different things.
So I found this episode really interesting. I think it's funny trying to understand humor, but I was thinking about my relationship with Ava. It's so much based on humor, don't you think, Ava?
That's true. Yes. So making light of all the situations. Yeah.
That's true. What I was going to say. So before we hit record, when we do these episodes, we talk for like an hour or 2 hours about kind of everything. And it's mostly us laughing about like really heavy stuff, light stuff, kind of everything. And it's such a big way that we connect in the way that we see the world. But I was thinking about, why do I find Ava so funny? And I think the differences between me and Ava is Ava's very like clever and witty, and she can just say things so quickly, and it just makes me laugh so much. And when I stay with her, we just are laughing all the time to the point of crying. And then I was thinking, I think the way, and Ava, you can reflect on this, I'm not so witty. It's just like more the things I actually do in life are funny.
I do think that you're funny without trying to be funny sometimes. I mean, we're laughing together, but I think it's just the way you are. And I do feel like I'll try to make jokes that are more explicitly like with the intention of being funny, but you're just like sitting in your little pile of clothes in the corner of my apartment, just like deer in headlights, throwing all your clothes around, like haven't done my laundry in 2 weeks, but it's okay. And I think you get into more zany situations than I do.
I get into a lot of, the way I live is funny, whereas you're more observationally funny. And that's interesting to think about it culturally, because I found my zany behavior, Netherlands, not accepted. Like, what's she doing? Not funny. France, they loved it. They were like, she's just running around the supermarket trying to translate things. Remember that. Everyone got involved, found it very funny, the way that I lived. So I think it's interesting, that cultural thing.
I was going to say, I feel like when you were in the Netherlands, it was a more serious situation, but it was actually exactly the same as when you were in France.
Exactly the same situation.
You did exactly the same thing. Do you want to share what you did? So it was exactly the same situation, actually. Yeah. At least you weren't, I mean, in the Netherlands, then you had to go to school.
Yeah, you didn't have to do that. PhD in France.
That's true.
Yeah. Anyway, third time's lucky, hopefully. Slide into those DMs.
Yeah, I think humor is very important at all times. But one of the things that I asked Hanu about was the role of humor. Is it good? Is it bad? And it seems like within the literature, there's this debate about whether it's useful, specifically for political efficacy, but in general, whether it's useful. And it seems like there's this idea about humor being bad, in quotation marks, but being like a peripheral processing cue. So it's something that distracts from the main point. But then Kanu was saying that actually it really depends on the type of humor. And I feel that humor is probably super hard to study because there's just so much variability in what people find funny and what exactly is that butt of the joke that we talked about. And I think with us, oftentimes the butt of the joke is us.
Yeah, that's true. It is so, really always us, yeah.
So I do think it's kind of an interesting question as to in politics, because I think a lot of the times with Daily Show, John Oliver, that type of show, it's very much like the butt of the joke is the conservatives. And it's maybe sometimes the host makes themselves the butt of the joke, but it's rarely like reflecting on the group. But maybe if you could reflect on the group, then that would also be a path to kind of lead to some reconciliations and recognition of something maybe that your group could do better.
I think it's hard, even in the political understanding news and stuff, I think without humor, I mean, it just gets too much and it's too heavy. And it's just like, you have to see some sort of light. And I think humor can bring that. And without that, it can seem pretty. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I feel like there's kind of this tension with what humor in the political landscape can do in terms of, let's say, just in news, like watching John Oliver versus watching just a plain news show about something that's happening, is that I think on the one hand, for me, and this is totally anecdotal, is I think it makes me more willing to engage with the content because it has this almost like a sugarcoating of you being able to take it better because you are also being entertained, and like maybe that reward that Connor didn't seem to find in that study, but I think is super important. But then I think the other half of it is, what does that humor then lead us to do about it? And this was a conversation that Connor and I had a little bit once we stopped recording, but sometimes I think those shows do have a call to action. And I think with John Oliver specifically, there's been instances where they've actually succeeded in influencing some kind of policy or influencing things that have happened in certain companies. But I think if you're also seeing something from a humorous perspective, it could also lead you to maybe not take it as seriously and to make you think, okay, there's people who are seeing this, who are making fun of it. Maybe that diffuses the threat. And maybe that means I'm kind of sedated. Like, this is okay, things are going fine. And maybe that leads to people not really wanting to engage as much with the seriousness of the topic. I think that's an open question, but I think it's a really interesting question because I do feel like once I've watched those shows, does it lead me to change what I do? Maybe not. It just makes me maybe oftentimes think, oh, like, look at all those dumb whoever was like doing this policy or that policy. And there are people who think it's funny. And therefore, if it's funny, that means maybe that we look down on it in a way where we think we still have control over the situation. So maybe it helps you engage because it's not as dark. But then is that engagement then as useful if we're talking about making changes to things that are happening?
So this might be fake news, I'm not sure.
Okay.
But I remember the 2016 election, Alec Baldwin played Trump on SNL. When Trump got in, apparently he felt really bad about making that his character on SNL like kind of light and funny. Like it didn't paint him in a good light, obviously, but it was making it kind of more accessible and like, oh, it's kind of funny. And like, yeah, kind of maybe more okay than it was.
Yeah, I think that was an issue that some of the other late night hosts had, where they, during the 2016 election, had both Clinton and Trump on, and people were upset about them platforming both of them, and also were upset about this fact that they were making light of this really dangerous situation. And I do think it's a double-edged sword, right? Like, that's how everything is. Like, the best parts of something are the worst parts of it as well, that the fact that we're able to kind of hold this information in the sense that this is what's really happening and I can deal with it because it's being delivered to me in this funny way. But then that leads to us downplaying it, right? Because you can take it in because it's downplayed, because otherwise it might be too much for you to deal with cognitively and emotionally. But then if it's downplayed, it's like, oh, it's fine. And I do think that's, you know, in our personal lives, I think that we do that as well.
Yeah, I agree.
We just did that off the recording.
Yeah. And I was thinking about how this works in Australia and Australian politics, because obviously that's very different. Australian politics, we also, what we do on a world scale just matters less. So we have crazy things go on, which in itself is a joke, but it doesn't make the world stage. I remember there was a thing where in Parliament, one of the members of Parliament called someone else an insane, terrible word. I cannot...
Like, you know what it is and can't repeat it? Terrible?
Yeah, I can't repeat it. And then the speaker had to say, we need to refer to people as their correct names. But, like, that's just how... Another member of Parliament recently was just found in Canberra after, like, a big night out, like, rolling around drunk. Like, it's just kind of, like, a whole kind of joke.
Yeah, that's really interesting, too, is, like, not only if the news is delivered in a funny way, but if the situation at hand has something that's, like, inherently potentially funny.
The way also our voting works is that you can get all these independents into Parliament who just have their own kind of parties. And one year this man got in who I think had like no political experience at all. And there was all these videos of him online just throwing like kangaroo poo at things.
What? Why?
I can't remember the details on why he was doing it, but it was just like this man sitting in Parliament, which... I think that that's kind of cool because it's representative maybe of more people. I'm not sure.
Okay, don't say that, Beth. As an Australian, I was like, that sounds like the most Australian thing I've ever heard. That's like an Australian pastime. And you're like, yep, that's what we do. Is that common?
No, but okay. It was just like, you know, country guy just being a larrikin, throwing stuff.
That's zany, Beth. I think you just come from the land of zaniness, honestly.
Have you seen the Simpsons episode where they go to Australia?
No.
Oh my God. Okay. You have to watch that. And it's like about Australian politics and it's so good.
Well, we all know what to do when we finish the episode. Show notes. Reminder, everything is in our show notes. Lots of good stuff in the show notes. MindsMatterPodcast.com.
We've talked a little bit about humor in general, like what it can do for us when we're thinking politically. But you have a new line of work that you mentioned that explores differences between the US and India specifically.
What I have done so far is trying to understand what already has been done. And it seems like this paradigm of media psychology type of work, which has been done in the US, has not been done in India.
Right.
Because it has been done in the US, there's a lot to like build on. Right. Mm-hmm. So there are measurements and experimental designs and operationalizations of a lot of these variables, which are considered pretty stable. That is just not the case in India. But there are also theories in the US, like the central and, you know, peripheral processing, or theories of humor, or theories of political behaviors, which a lot of these studies build on, which also does not necessarily translate to India either. Much of my work right now is trying to build some of that, to build what kind of theory could be developed for the effects of humor in that space. How can we operationalize humor or political humor? How can we operationalize variables like political efficacy in India, different political behaviors in India, etc.? So for that, the first thing that I have been trying to do is studying the literature on humor and satire in India writ large. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is in the ethnographic, critical cultural kind of space. So in the humanities, their analyses look very different than what our analyses look like. However, they're also making certain claims and assumptions and suggestions about how humor plays a role in citizenship. So from those, I have tried to surmise what is the currently understood way in which humor is working in politics right now. This is a current work in progress, but there are three themes that I observed. One is that some researchers have been talking about how humor has become this new public sphere where people come together, joke about politics, and are able to have an uninhibited space of political discourse. And they're specifically talking about the stand-up culture. And there are severe critiques of this thought as well, because these spaces are not uninhibited. These spaces are not uncensored. Mm-hmm. So that is one way to think about it, that humor is creating, in some ways, a different space in which norms about politics and whatnot are negotiated. The other is the theme of masculinity. And a lot of stand-up continues to be dominated by men. Mm-hmm. A lot of styles of jokes are dominated by masculinist logics of male dominance. So there would be a lot of jokes about identities which are non-male, hypersexualizing female bodies, hypersexualizing non-male bodies, making fun of queer people, mm-hmm. etc. So that is definitely the case across the globe, definitely in the US as well, and definitely the case in India as well. And when you then talk about political humor, those masculinist logics enter in that space as well. So politics in general seems to be a masculine space as well. Mm-hmm. Humor seems to be a masculine space as well. When they're put together, it seems like a lot of logics of what is allowed to say, what is not allowed to say, logics of what is considered funny, what is not considered funny. Some people have talked about how a lot of them seem to come under masculinist logics. Men seem to be more empowered in politics. Men seem to have more access to digital devices. Men seem to have more access to spaces of stand-up and doing comedy. A lot of these norms are established by them. What effect does it have on how political humor is affecting one's citizenship? Whom is it including and excluding? And it seems like it is overrepresenting men in that way. So that is something that I'm interested in as well, to figure out what is the role of gender. And not just gender, but norms of masculinity, or what role is it playing in making humor more effective, less effective for some people versus other people, etc. So that is one theme that I also observed. Then there was a theme of networked participation, of how people are creating humor through memes. And more interpersonally, when they share something with each other, they would add a caption to it or whatever. And that is one way in which people actively participate in the creation of humor about politics and talking about politics. In different contexts, this type of network participation has intersections with both of the other things that I talked about public spheres and about the dominance of masculinist logics. With the current availability of digital media, people have the ability to create different types of media as well. And that moves the focus away from looking at humor as this like top-down system where humor is projected onto somebody and they are exposed to it and they get humored, as opposed to like humor is, you know, co-constructed and socially constructed. And that seems to have some effect in people feeling more or less empowered, feeling like they are playing with politics in some way or the other. And that seems to be playing some kind of role in how people perceive political information, understand them, make meaning of them. So those are the three themes that I'm seeing over there.
In those three themes, are there big differences that you see between the US and India? Because especially when we were talking about the John Oliver and like this idea of the new public sphere, it feels like a lot of, maybe that's just, you know, my own bias, what I'm exposed to, but I feel like when I go to a stand-up show, sometimes there's politics, but a lot of times it's just like, my mom's so crazy.
My wife's a bitch. Yeah. Sorry, yeah.
Honestly, yeah.
Yeah. Like a lot of comedy is that. It's awful. Like it's misogynistic. It's sexist. It's either talking about that or talking about drugs or talking about, you know, some kind of shock value. And there are specific logics of stand-up culture as well and what gets them the money and what keeps these spaces in business and all of that can be gotten into as well. These are not necessarily spaces where people are coming together for civic discourse. Like they are coming there to, in some cases, just let their demons out.
Yeah.
So I would say in some ways it can be a public sphere, or at least the history of stand-up culture in the US alludes to that, right? Like it started around the Prohibition era and a lot of comedy was happening in basements. And that's why there is this whole culture of like a mic in front of like a exposed wall, because those were in the basements of these spaces. And now it has become a whole culture where people are not putting up wallpapers of exposed brick. So there's definitely potential of it being a public sphere. Whether it is or not is a whole different thing. In India, I would say a lot of what is considered comedy is stand-up comedy, and a lot of what is considered stand-up comedy right now is aspirational towards US standards of stand-up comedy. So the formats that they use, the jokes, writing structures that they use, all of that is based on what the US stand-up culture looks like. A lot of these norms are established in the US, which just get kind of like carried over in India. A lot of them look up to American stand-up comedians as well, their style of comedy as well. Especially in that time that I was talking about when I was in college and noticing that there were some people doing these things on YouTube. They were all also just like trying to follow the formats of sketch comedy formats, of joke writing and all of that as was done in the US. They hosted this like roast the way they do over here, right? Like Comedy Central roasts. So that was not usual in India. So they hosted a Comedy Central style roast with some very high profile celebrities in the movie industry over there. And then that wasn't received very well. Once it released, it was suddenly made into like a media circus, and multiple police complaints were filed against them for public indecency, even though it happened months ago and it was put on YouTube months later. It became a whole thing. And then a roast like that has never happened after that.
Wow.
Yeah. But then now, after a while, once people were exposed to that, they were like, oh, we kind of like this. So slightly less intense roast-like shows started popping up on mainstream TV, on YouTube, etc. And now there are some kind of YouTube channels which do, you know, like roast shows, but like not at that scale.
But were the celebrities themselves who were being roasted involved in the planning?
I mean, they have to be to an extent, right?
But like, then what?
They did not file it. The police
were just like,
because it was just like a moral outrage. Like, how dare they use expletives? And this is against Indian culture and whatnot.
Okay, that's really interesting.
Yeah, they just like made a boogeyman out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's, and that was done a lot after that as well. A lot of comedians and their jokes were made into a media circus. And then that has led to a lot of self-censorship among comedians.
So in terms of this public sphere, you also talked about who actually has access to this public sphere, who's in the public. And this brings me to a question that I was thinking about in terms of the implications of this. So, because it feels like, especially in what you were saying in terms of like, people who aren't men or aren't male being the butt of the joke, do you feel that like humor, there always has to be some kind of like divisiveness in it because there has to be a butt of the joke, or can it be something that brings everyone together? And you know, in the US at least, if you watch like John Oliver, there is like the conservatives become the butt of the joke. What do you think about comedy in terms of that? And does there always have to be a target?
Even when comedy is bringing people together, there is a target of the joke. The way jokes are constructed, there is, I think, always something that is being made fun of. Whether it is a concept, whether it is an inanimate object, whether it is an actual person, whether it is a group of people, whether it is an ideology, whatever it is, something is being made fun of. So in that way, even if it is bringing people together, it might be bringing people together who are not the butt of the joke, for instance, right? Depending on what the norms are, it might be making fun of like a third party or something like that, which can make the two groups which might feel divided come closer together. In certain settings and cultural norms, one can also foresee a situation where, or imagine a situation where openly making fun of the other group can make you feel closer as well, right? Like that is partly what proponents of the American style of roasts would say. They would say that our honesty in this really aggressive, profane way makes for a space where like there is nothing that is prohibited to talk about and say, and that makes us come closer to each other. And they can all, you know, hurl really, really personal abuses and insults at each other and then have a drink. So at a surface level, humor can operate in many different ways, just like a hammer can help you build a table and commit murder. A humor can also help you bring people together or commit murder. So it can do both in that way. It's a tool which can be used in one way or the other. To your question of how can it bring people together and is there potential for bringing people together in some way or the other, especially in politics, when we are seeing that there are right-wing memes and comedies that make fun of and use derogatory words towards people that they don't like or agree with. In the similar way, we see derogatory words or whatever being used by people who are on the more liberal, progressive side of things as well. With that, I would say if the goal is unity, then sure, there are solutions to that which can include humor in it. You can create jokes and humorous shows and environments where everybody can have some kind of laughter and they can feel unified about that. But then if the goal is justice, then unity is not necessarily the goal, because the structures of power that are creating the divisiveness, they are not necessarily at the same level at the people that they are creating problems for. So for instance, if we are talking about, let's say this is an extreme, extreme case. So let's say we are talking about slavery, mm-hmm. and not just like the United States slavery, like slavery as just a concept across the world. If you are talking about, you would love there to be, you know, a lack of violence and there to be peace and there to be liberty, right? So we would not want the slaves to be enslaved. But then to say that the goal is unity among the slave owners and the slaves is innocently not looking at the fact that the reason why this exists is because one particular group holds a particular power, mm-hmm. and they are not at the same level. So perhaps to get to a place where unity is even on the table, the assessment of the jokes sometimes cannot be just from a view of like whether it is making fun of another person or not. It perhaps should be from a view of whether the jokes are making fun of our structures or not. And in that process, it might make fun of people. It might make fun of groups of people as well. But then, especially people who write about and think about humor as resistance and humor as something that can push towards a world which is more just, they would say that making fun of people is not necessarily the worst thing, because sometimes it can serve towards creating more solidarity among the people who are powerless, giving them some level of catharsis and empowerment. And for a small moment, you know, degrade or derogate people that have more material power over the other group. So that is what I would say about that. So when you're talking about general politics as well, absolutely, there's something to be said about not using personal remarks and ad hominem remarks, etc. But that also cannot be looked at with the same moral standards for all groups, right? Yeah, that's what I would say about that.
Mic drop. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you to Dr. Pratikshit Pandey, aka Kanu, for joining us this episode.
Our intro and outro music is Nobody Stayed for the DJ by Glacio. Our transition music is Back for More, also by Glacio. Minds Matter is mixed, edited, and created by Beth Fisher, she's the Australian one, and me, Ava Montesouza. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode, but in the meantime, find all our episodes and show notes on mindsmatterpodcast.com. Thank you.